What in God's Name is in Summer Replay. Please enjoy our top conversations from this program year. If you have ideas for interesting guests, for future shows, drop us a line. We are always and ever grateful for the ways our listeners support our work. You can support our work by leaving us a review. You can join our roster of donors at patreon.com and get on our mailing list at whatingods.com. You are listening to What in God's Name. We're here to provide a place where we can all help each other see more deeply and more hopefully into our shared common life. Subscribe to What in God's Name wherever you get your podcasts. We're talking today with John Askinas. John is an assistant professor of politics at the Catholic University of America. I found John because of his article, Possessed in America, which appears in Mere Orthodoxy, an online journal, and we'll put the link to John's piece in our show notes. In this article, John talks about, he writes about the mass shootings in the United States. And John, you wrote that in 2019.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's still relevant.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to talk to you a little bit about that in terms of how things might have changed or stayed the same. But at any rate, John, thank you for taking the time to come and be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we like to ground our listening community in the story, the stories of, the background of our guests on the show. So if you could say a little bit, John, about where you're from and how did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, I grew up in outside Chicago in an independent fundamental Baptist faith community, very tight-knit, very focused on scripture, but also at the same time a little bit anti-intellectual in terms of, you know, the scripture is sort of sufficient for everything you might want to know. And I was always more sort of intellectually curious than that, and so I wanted to go out and to explore the world a little bit more in college, and so I ended up going to Georgetown University. As you mentioned in our brief conversation before, Chris, there were sort of people who were both totally intellectually vibrant and totally faithful Christians, and that was a wonderful community to encounter. And I sort of feel I was there at a kind of almost a golden moment in terms of the people who were there at Georgetown at that time, some of whom have gone on to do really interesting and eminent things. Emma Green, for instance, who's now at The New Yorker, wrote a piece on Hillsdale College that was really insightful. You know, she was a friend of mine from Georgetown. Patrick Deneen was still there at the end of his time there. So that was an amazing experience. And I attended a Reformed Baptist church in my time there, which was in some ways, in very many ways, a model of what a church could be or should be. But my experiences there, as well as the kind of things I was reading and thinking about and talking to, led me to a more sacramental understanding of Christianity. And so when I went to Oxford for my graduate school, I joined the Church of England, and that's sort of where, that's the faith tradition that I feel like I've really blossomed in, along with my family. So that's sort of my background. I came back to AIDS, and now I teach politics and international relations at Catholic University.
Before we get into the specifics of your piece on gun violence, I wanted to start with a more general question, which, again, you and I just talked about a little bit before we started recording. But my observation is that often our, and this is a premise of the project that we're involved in that leads to this podcast, which leads to this conversation, often when we as a society consider public questions, we gravitate, it seems unthinkingly, immediately to political considerations. And I'm attracted to the kind of thinking that I think is a piece of, at least I discern this from the writing that you put forward here that we're going to talk about gun violence, that there are spiritual realities, psycho-spiritual realities at work in society that are more fundamental than the political. And I want to begin by asking you if you agree with that and how you might amplify that or say it differently.
No, that's a really interesting point, Chris. And I definitely do agree with that. I mean, so certainly the political community and the choices that a political community can make can condition a lot of things about society. Nonetheless, it's sort of clear that it's not the most fundamental thing. I mean, the political community usually presupposes a real society, including a spiritual mood or a spiritual, a formative environment, an environment that forms people. And I think the more that you study history, the more apparent, particularly if you really get deep in the weeds, the more apparent it is that there are things that go on politically, socially, economically, that can't be explained by a kind of billiard ball approach to policy, action, reaction, and interest and whatnot. The philosopher René Girard writes about what he calls political atheism. By political theism, he means sort of the belief in the state and the power of the state as sort of the real thing. Some political atheists are atheists because they're cynics. But then he also says Jesus Christ is a political atheist, by which he means they're equally disenchanted of the state as sort of and political power as a fundamental reality, but not because they're cynical about it, but because they believe that the political is just another stage for a yet deeper kind of reality. The kind of key venue for understanding this idea of political atheism is sort of the gospel narrative, and especially Jesus' trial by the high priest. And if you look at the motivations that Caiaphas has, I mean, that even that line, is it better for one man to die than the whole people perish, right? It means completely different things to a political theist and to a political atheist, right? So there's a lot more to talk about there. But yes, I completely agree with you. The point of this piece is that we can't leave it at the political. We have to reckon with the underlying spiritual needs of our society.
Let's talk about your piece, Possessed in America. Again, it's in Mere Orthodoxy for our listening community, and you can Google it. The link will be in the show notes. There's a few pieces of this that I want to raise, but one phrase that got me, and that you were talking again, you used a work by Dostoevsky called The Possessed as your jumping off point here, and a phrase you used is a social spiritual void demands the infinite promise of surrender to a totalizing force. So this is from Dostoevsky, but again, to my sensibility, it's very appropriate to American culture today, and it's especially this sense of a social spiritual void. Can you talk about that? How, and again, you wrote this piece in 2019. Can you remember what you were thinking then and how you're thinking about it, if it's different now, about that social spiritual void? And I have some ideas about this, but I want to hear from you.
Yeah, I wrote this piece in kind of all in a rush after yet another school shooting. I'm ashamed to say I can't remember which one it was. And to your question about the social spiritual void, the most important thing to understand or imagine about mass shootings was the motives of people. And it's funny, it's the first thing that sort of skirted over. And in any particular shooting, right, there's this rush to look at the particularized motives of the shooter, you know, what political, ideological, identity obsessions they might have. But that seems obviously to be insufficient to mass shooters as a class, who engage in mass shooting over any number of identities. And that's what drew me back to Dostoevsky. I studied Dostoevsky's Demons with the wonderful Olga Meerson, my great teacher at Georgetown. And she highlighted the kind of connection to apophatic theology of Dostoevsky's analysis in Demons, which is that it's the sort of the void at the center, which is the cause of the possession. If you have a void like that, there will be a possession. This is actually sort of standard Christian demonology, sort of this notion of of the unnaturalness of the void, and that that's the explanation, that the motives are sort of epiphenomenal, the particularized motives are sort of epiphenomenal to the underlying spiritual void.
Since you mentioned it, do share. I would love to hear about your motivation for writing the piece and how you were feeling at the time.
Yeah, well, I sort of alluded to it a second ago, which is, you know, I think a certain amount of anger and sadness about the details of any of these shootings are always so heartbreaking if you can bear to look at them, alongside the kind of nihilistic needlessness of the whole thing. And just feeling that the analysis, that the hot takes that immediately flow forward were so inadequate to the obvious depth of the problem, you know. And to your point at the beginning about political, about this ignorance of and ignoring of the spiritual dimension, both the left and the right sort of rushed to give what are essentially political takes of what policies we ought to adopt that would solve this. And it seems to me that any policy framework which doesn't reckon with the fact that people are desiring to annihilate school children and mall goers and festival goers, that seems to be the obvious problem here, is that someone wants to annihilate school children. Like, what is going on in your society that that's the case? Practical issues aside. So that was the kind of motivation behind the piece.
Thanks for that, John. I went through the exercise of listing components of our social spiritual void. Like, I tried to flesh that out a little bit. So I want to share with you...
A daunting task.
A daunting task indeed. Let me share with you my list, and I would love to hear your rejoinders, things you would add, subtract. The social spiritual void. We are fundamentally alone and abandoned. So a sense in our culture of that ties into the whole disenchantment element. We are alone in the universe, radically alone. Human life is a commodity. So the preponderance, the dominance of economic kinds of thinking that permeate then our view of the human being. The human being is a commodity. There's no such thing as truth. No such thing as goodness. This kind of radical relativism element. Fear is more fundamental than faith. Fear is our fundamental state of being. Scarcity is more fundamental than abundance. And the last one I wrote is everything is about power or wealth. Which, everything is about power or wealth. That's a void because then the obvious next question is not asked, which is what do you want your power for? What do you want your wealth for? So that's my list. I just came up with that. I'm curious as to if you have any response.
Yeah, well, I'll go along by memory to the best of my knowledge. I think the first thing you said is by far the most important, which is the sense of being atomized and alone. But it's actually worse than that, right? It's abandoned, not just atomized and alone, but having been not that and been abandoned. The common theme, both in Dostoevsky's novel Demons and amongst basically every school shooter, is fatherlessness. If you look at almost every mass shooter, the type is one in which the father is either absent or neglectful in some or abusive in some fundamental way. It's not universal, but it's nearly universal. Which also, by the way, you know, is in our mass shooting statistics, we often, this is another grim fact, we mix together two kinds of mass shootings. We mix together the sort of random spree shootings, for whom they're all done by men. The random spree shootings are almost exclusively white men and some Asian men, but usually middle class, even upper middle class. Then the other kind of mass shooting that gets lumped in statistically are targeted shootings that nonetheless injure or kill enough people to be considered mass shootings, which are usually associated with gang violence of some kind, the perpetrators of which are again, almost always men, but usually African-American men. But what they all have in common is fatherlessness. So, you know, and the Mary Aberstadt wrote a wonderful book on the rage and the kind of rage that emerges from having been abandoned by one's father, especially amongst young men. And of course, we could talk about the causes of fatherlessness.
What's the name of that book?
Yeah, it's and she particularly ties it to some of the consequences of the sexual revolution. You don't have to buy that part of the analysis to appreciate the psychological research which she marshals on the effects of fatherlessness, but it's called Primal Screams. So, you know, Primal Screams, how the sexual revolution created identity politics. But the underlying analysis is about the effects of fatherlessness. So that was the first one you said. The second one you said was...
Human life is a commodity.
Yeah, life is a commodity. Yeah, I do think that something around... You know, I don't think anyone would say that we have a society that emphasizes human dignity, intrinsic human worth. We have a society where the messaging and the sort of lived experience is one in which one's value is tied to, you know, economic or political characteristics or that over which one has little say. And so I do think that many mass shooters are people who have been told that they have no value time and again. And I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, some have argued, I don't know how I feel about this entirely, but some have argued that the kind of, it's not a coincidence that this kind of shooting emerges really sort of in high schools and sort of, which is really the first place where many people run into, you know, are oppressed by or run into this sort of, the rank ordering in American society in an institutional sense. I think the cat's out of the bag. I think now it's quite more complicated than that, but that's not irrelevant. What was the next item on your list?
Well, you don't have to go through all of them.
Okay. Well, okay. Yeah, fair enough. There's a few things that I thought were missing.
Yeah, good. That's what I wanted to hear. Yeah.
There's a rage that underlies this kind of thing, this school shooting, that I think we have to get our hands around. And I don't think it's simply, I mean, sure, moral relativism and the kind of disappearance of transcendence, those all play a role in this sort of social spiritual void. But I think that, this is going to sound crazy, but I think boredom and a kind of metaphysical boredom is such an important part of this motivation. There's scarcely a school shooter who did not stew in boredom, a certain kind of boredom, and a certain kind of uselessness for a very long time first. And I was struck by this connection which Dante makes in the Divine Comedy between acedia, the noonday demon, the inability to be productive either at work or in prayer, and wrath. He puts them in the same, they're both in the fifth circle together. And the connection is not obvious. What's the connection between someone who's just unproductively bored, unable to rouse themselves to do anything, and the wrathful? And Dante makes the connection. He says, we were sullen in the sweet air that is gladdened by the sun, bearing in our hearts a sluggish smoke. Now we are sullen in the black mire. When you are struck by this kind of paralysis of will, you become wrathful at people who are not. And it's a particularly generalized or not targeted wrath, right? Because anybody who's doing anything, anybody who's engaged in the world, then becomes someone, a subject of your anger. And we have a society, we have an economy that depends on acedia, that depends on addiction, that depends on consumerism, that depends on sedating people with a kind of bare minimum of pleasure. And certain people, they get stuck in that in a real way. And I think, again, if you look at the profile of shooters, they're very often people who are sort of stuck in acedia.
I'd like to explore this a little bit more because I'm fascinated with, and I know you wrote about this in your piece about acedia. And do you, in your understanding of acedia, is it fundamental in and of itself, or can it be analyzed does it have its genesis in something deeper?
That's an interesting question.
Yeah, and the reason, because I'm trying to put my mind around it, and so what I was thinking of, John, is, and again, you do write about this in your piece, about the failure to have stories within which we can find meaning in life. Mm-hmm. And so my question is really kind of, does acedia arise from arise from a sense of meaninglessness, or is it the other way around?
it's a great question, Chris, and it's a really good question. So I think on the one hand, having a very strong sense of mission and purpose is a very powerful remedy. You know, knowing what you are about, what you are trying to achieve, especially a sense of urgency about that. You don't have time to be bogged down. So that's, I think that is absolutely a part of it. You know, if you have a society that refuses to tell you or help you find something of transcendent purpose in your life, and just says you're here to have a good time, have the best time you can before you die, then why? So I think that is absolutely part of the problem. On the flip side, though, I will say there is something slippery about acedia. You know, and the monastics, they basically said that acedia is what destroys monastic communities. Not lust, not greed, not acedia specifically. And it's because I think, and this is the connection to technology, is because it doesn't attach itself to any particular act of the will. It's invisible in that sense, right? So any other sin that I might engage in, greed, lust, I'm choosing to do something rather than nothing. I'm sure, something I ought not be doing over something I ought to be doing. But acedia is almost about not making that choice and just sort of that moment of indecision and dwelling in that moment of indecision. And so the fact that you don't have to have a kind of pre-commitment of the will, in fact, acedia is that thing that wants you to avoid that pre-commitment of the will, is what's so slippery about it. There's no ideology behind it.
That's tremendous. You're bringing in the will that really does get at something that's at work in our culture and society. You know, I heat my house with a wood stove, and the physical act of cutting wood, splitting it, stacking it, I have to bring it into my wood stove. If I don't engage my will, I will get cold. But we live in a society where everything is pretty much just brought to us. And so acedia, in this sense of the will not needing to do anything, is pervasive in our culture. So thank you for that. I would love to finish with, I want to read the last paragraph of your piece and just get your, you know, as you hear these words again, I'm going to read them. You wrote them 4 years ago. As you hear these words again, what strikes you as so, so true and that you want to amplify? And just, I would love your reactions as you hear your words again. So this is the last paragraph of John's piece. He says, as with most sins, individual and societal, the consequences that we hate are the inevitable byproduct of the sins that we love. We make an idol of freedom, in quotes, meant as license and unrestraint, the myth of the triumphant individual, and remove any barriers to his emancipation. For the sake of the economy, again in quotes, we idolize consumption and pleasure-seeking and dismiss productive work and meaningful self-constraint. We deny the legitimacy of a spiritual turmoil with its necessary ramifications of human frailty, sin and responsibility, and need for redemption, and instead insist upon a therapeutic analysis which removes one's agency even over one's own mind. If we want to stop mass shootings, we need to build a different kind of society. What can it mean that we blink over the slaughter of school children and innocent revelers? Could it be any more obvious that mass shootings are not the isolated acts of unstable losers, but a part of a battle for the American soul? It's interesting, John, you end your piece with two sentences that are questions. The last two things you write are questions. At any rate, how do you hear these words?
Yeah, no, I appreciate you reading that, Chris. And you know, I think I ended it with questions because I wanted people to kind of dwell on and think about it a little bit. I didn't want it to be, you know, whatever the opposite of a hot take is. I wanted, you know, and I think the piece part holds up well enough because it wasn't trying to have a hot take. I think the thing that strikes me, everything in that paragraph I feel has continued to be true or maybe even deepened. But the thing that I think most troubles me, that which we appear heading in just the exact wrong direction, is continuing to deny the legitimacy of spiritual turmoil and refusing to even have a vocabulary for spiritual turmoil. And this sort of, you know, what I think was Philip Reif called the triumph of the therapeutic, right? It's, I feel like that's only intensified. And it's this sort of, you know, it's a sort of trap, right? Where the more we deny the spiritual, the reality of the spiritual, the more we deny a language of spiritual struggle, the more awful things happen in our society, and the more we lean on this language of the therapeutic to explain it. You know, there are certainly people who struggle with, you know, diagnosable psychological disorders, but the resort to the language of mental health as the single default language of personal struggle is, I think, so damaging and such a bad sign. Because there's no agency. One doesn't have it. It's something that happens to one. And so I think that's, the denying the legitimacy of spiritual turmoil and insisting on sort of the therapeutic approach is, I think, the thing about that paragraph that has, in my mind, worsened the most over the last few years. And there's a kind of, just to kind of riff on that a little bit, you know, to be controversial maybe, I think there's a connection between acedia and this sort of therapeutic language. Because at some point, it encourages you to focus on analyzing yourself as if the path to the kind of life you want is found in self-analysis, rather than in different practices, right? And a different way of living, right? And so you end up with, you end up focusing on yourself instead of understanding the limitations of the self, understanding the limitations of self-knowledge. Because that is the most damaging thing at the end, is that your reward for the engaging in this process is you know yourself, but it doesn't change you. Right, knowing you have anxiety, social anxiety, or knowing that you have, you struggle with destructive thought patterns or whatever, that's it. That's the end of the road. And then what? Right. So just at the level of kind of, I think the language we use is so important, and that older spiritual language of struggle, of of ups and downs, of a kind of a moral narrative to one's life, where one wasn't defined by one's immediate, only defined by one's immediate circumstances. I think that offers so much more promise for action than this sort of therapeutic language.
That's so interesting, your emphasis on the necessity for spiritual. I'm not sure you use the word necessity, so correct me if I'm not, if that's a mischaracterization, but the necessity of spirit, it's, to me, it's human. And I feel like it's interesting you made a connection to acedia, because as you were talking, I was thinking that a connection too, but I would I articulated it to myself a slightly different way, which is this whole sense of frictionlessness. Like if we don't accept, if we don't accept spiritual turmoil as part of the authentic journey, and we go for fixing things and make it, so to me, that's the connection. What you can avoid is engaging the work of being a human being.
Yes, absolutely. And worse than that, you have people who sort of knowledge our society validates telling you that, and telling you that the solution is, in many cases, is to sedate yourself with a pharmaceutical of some kind. And then the problem is, you know, if it works, what does that say about you? And if it doesn't work, and it rarely works the way it's promised to work, then what else do you do? I mean, the rates of pharmaceuticals use, again, quite apart from their therapy, their medical necessity in for many people. But looking at the level of society, like, you know, we've been developing psychopharmaceuticals for 70 years now, almost. Do we have a society with better or worse mental health than when we started? I don't know. That seems to be an important question to ask.
Let me guess. I think it's worse.
So what does that say about the, you know, if you go to a doctor and all the doctor's patients are ending up worse off than they started, what does it say about the doctor?
John, thank you so much. I just want to give you a chance if there's something I didn't ask that you wish I had, or anything that you would like to say further that you haven't had a chance to say at this point.
No, just I really appreciate you having me on, Chris, and I think these are definitely the conversations that we need to be having as a society, so thank you for talking with me.
I'm so grateful you spent the time. We've been speaking with John Askinas. John is an assistant professor of politics at the Catholic University of America. We've been discussing in more detail his article, his writing, his piece, Possessed in America. You can find it in Mere Orthodoxy, an online journal. And of course, as I've said twice already, we will have the link to that in the show notes. John, thank you so much.
If you like what you've heard today, and you like what the What in God's Name Project is doing, please consider sponsoring our work for less than $1 a week on Patreon. It's barely any money for you, but it means a lot to us, and so we thank you. And also sign up for our newsletter and stay in touch with developments on our project at whatingods.com, whatingods.